Greetings, kindred witches. Welcome to the Atomic Hearth for this Sunday Haven.
Here we share our experiences as we build a modern-day inclusive witchcraft practice rooted in nature's seasons, celestial cycles, and the science of energy.
Join us as we build a practice that learns from our past, is rooted in our present, and works toward building a better future, all while connecting deeply to the earth and sky around us.
Let us begin a new era of witchcraft. Hi, everyone. Welcome to our grove here at the Atomic Hearth.
As always, we are so grateful for this community and for all of you choosing to spend a portion of your Sunday here with us.
We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge that we are currently here on the lands of the Coast Salish peoples, more specifically, the Duwamish and Muckleshoot tribes. We want to take a moment here to honor the ancestors of the land on which we reside. Thank you.
Welcome back. In this episode, we are continuing our conversation about an earth-based witchcraft practice. In part one of Earth Witchery, we mentioned the many different flavors an earth-based practice may come in. And while we did a brief overview of each path before, we're going to really dig into some of them today in a bit more depth during this episode. We fully admit that these are big subjects, and there is no way we'll be able to cover everything in just one episode. So we have divided the content into three easy-to-access episodes: a green path, a stoneway, and earth elementals.
And remember, when building a practice and knowing where to get started, the sapling earthcraft provides a foundation, and each wheel turn builds on that foundation, adding more layers, expanding out to include additional elements, and adding skills stone by stone. This eventually culminates in what we call the witch wheel turn. Here, under the witch earth element, it's about putting the finishing touches on this skill set with advanced earth elementals and the power of magnetics and earthquakes. From there, it's appropriate to embark on a more specific and unique journey. Let's get started where we most expect it, outside, with our resident green or earth witch.
Ah, yes, the green path, or the green witch path. As Ash mentioned previously, this is the one that we hear about the most. It's kind of the most popular and the one that has many, many books written on it. This is kind of the most classic witchcraft path that comes to mind when we say earth witchery. The big focus here is going to be all things growing from the earth, so plants, trees, flowers, etc. And this could be wild or cultivated. Think natural growth versus gardens. If you want to start following a green practice, the magics you can focus on now include trees, herbs, nature knowing, nature tuning, roots, gardening, growing, flower, and even solar or water and weather magics to a degree. And this practice can be started simply by tending to your own plants. You can start by tending a garden, or take frequent walks in nature, or even lovingly care for your houseplants. Anything that gets you out and connected to the green and growing side of the natural world. You may also want to have fresh flowers or herbs on your altar and make a point to change them out frequently to keep things lively. And of course, be mindful of the green world everywhere you go. Pay attention to the energy, slow down, connect, notice where the flowers are coming up out of the concrete and how the leaves turn with the changes of the seasons. It's all about being mindful. And as we mentioned, there are so many books on walking a green path, seeing as this is a very popular one. So when looking for resources, these can be great options. Just make sure it's the best source for you and does not appropriate from indigenous practices or sources, as those sources should definitely be credited or paid. Or focus on reading writings by indigenous authors, such as Robin Wall Kimmer, who wrote Braiding Sweetgrass and Gathering Moss. Gardening books are also a wonderful source of knowledge, especially since so many of them cover all aspects of growing, from root to crown. See if you can find one that features growing in your local area. And hey, there's a lot of popular opinions on this path right now that you need to have some kind of big innate connection, or that you need to be barefoot in your garden every moment of every day to be a green witch. And honestly, do the best that you can. All you need is a love for the natural world and a willingness to learn and engage. Now, this path is one that can very easily be practiced with a group of friends, family, additional witches. You can host gardening parties or have your kids help pull weeds and have picnics in the park. And of course, as most paths, this can be practiced alone and discreetly. After all, no one will question someone misting their peace lilies with care.
Getting a little more into the specific paths here, an herbalist witch built a path around the growth, care, and cultivation of herbs. This work, alongside learning about their specific lore and unique properties, then connects into a whole variety of ways to use herbal, root, flower elements into your spell work and overall practice. Now for me, the magics that herbs find their way naturally into are meditation, astral work, protection and cleansing work, candle and aroma magic, and in building many rituals. Now specific to how I work with herbs, scent is a really helpful tool for easing my busy mind to help with meditation or spending time in the astral. And in that way, I find it's a really helpful companion for any energy work I'm doing to help clear the noise away and be fully open and receptive. Growing herbs yourself is a great step toward personalizing what you're working with. But if you're aiming to build a more robust practice around herbs, exploring the lore and history of them will deepen that understanding, which may be culturally significant depending on the herb and where it's natively found. A unique way I personally tie herbs into my path is actually how I tie it into my kitchen witch tendencies, specifically into drink making. Growing herbs and to then build into an infusion, a bitters blend, or maybe just a scent accent to elevate the sensory experience when taking sips, like think a sprig of mint. This was how I engaged with and appreciated herbs the most before I ever began my journey into the world of witchcraft. And thanks to herbs being so common in my own culture and customs in America and uses like this, building on a practice in this realm has been an easy one to be quite public and shareable with friends and family. But as always, when it comes to practices that involve other people, especially in drinking or eating things, always make sure you have consent before offering something as part of a spell.
Yeah, as Jay mentioned above, that sort of aromatherapy and scent aspect and consuming aspect of herbs is a really great way to get into that herbalist witch path. But you can also take more of a healing lens to it in creating tinctures, teas, salves for magical and healing purposes. With that in mind, some magics you could focus on are, of course, herbs and garden and growing, but also potions, elixirs, water and cleansing, flowers, aromatherapy, or any combination of these. As Jay mentioned, growing your own herbs is a great way to connect to this path, but you can take it a step further and study really deeply the properties of each. How have they been used historically? How can they be used in the modern day? Can you use all parts of the herb for the same purpose, or does each part have different properties? For instance, a chamomile plant, if you want to make a tea, you're going to use the flowers rather than the leaves. You can take this to an even higher level and begin experimenting with making your own teas, salves, poultices, etc. from the herbs. To get started in this, I recommend checking out books on herbalism. And the ones with a witchcraft lean are okay, but I personally prefer sources that have a scientific and historical backing. Or you can even check out the gardening sections of your library or local bookshops for tips on growing, using, and storing herbs. And of course, keep in mind that when you're practicing, that dry herbs versus fresh herbs have different properties, strengths, and should be used in specific ways. For example, you can use fresh or dried herbs for teas, but if you're infusing with oil for a long time, it is best to use dried herbs. Otherwise, your fresh herbs could get funky. No one wants that. And I really want to emphasize this, but herbalism and herbal remedies will not replace vaccines and many modern medicines, especially for more severe illnesses. And also, if you have allergies or take medications or are pregnant, nursing, etc., it's really best to consult a doctor before integrating herbal remedies into your own personal life. And as Jay said, this is a really great way to engage with your community and family. Practicing and growing herbs and practicing herbalism is a great way to connect with other people. But of course, you can always practice this a little bit discreetly.
Yeah, and this is just a gentle reminder that all aspects of your craft path are optional. I am allergic to a lot of plants and herbs, especially, so I actually sit this one out. But now maybe you're more into foraging for ingredients than cultivating a garden. And if that's the case, then what, Alyssa?
Then we have the forager witch. This is one who spends their days in the wild, learning from native flora and fauna. It's a little bit of a subpath, so it can tie back into things like hedge witchery, but also the green path, and I would say even into eco-witchery. Some magics to really dive into to familiarize yourself with this practice include nature knowing and nature tuning. Those are the two biggest ones. But you can also focus on any and all of the plant-based earth magics. So trees, herbs, mushrooms, roots, flowers. One of the best ways to get started on this path is to learn about the native plants in your area, especially edibles. This goes hand in hand with learning proper plant identification, and I mean from a really well-researched sources or even groups in your area that teach foraging. I know here in Seattle, we have the Puget Sound Mycological Society, that is a hard word to say, that takes groups out on mushroom foraging trips. This is a really, really important part of the path because there are many plants out there that can make you very sick or even cause death if you misidentify something. So learn your poisons just as much as you learn your edibles. And one of the most important practices for a forager witch, or even just a forager, is mindful harvesting. Only ever take what you need and leave plenty in the area so that what you're foraging can continue to grow and produce or go to seed and spread in the fall. And don't exhaust one source or patch. See if you can't harvest a little bit from a few areas rather than a lot from one. The only exception to this rule, I will say, is if you're contributing to invasive removal via foraging. For example, parts of the United States are plagued by garlic mustard, which is very, very invasive and aggressive, and many organizations encourage depleting as much of this edible as you can. Look up, do the research, find the best practices for your area. Now, there's quite a few social accounts I really like that really illustrate foraging and foraging practice as well, including the Black Forager, who we have recommended so many times while you're on this podcast. She really dives into proper foraging practices, how to ID plants. So if you're a visual learner, there's some really good content. There's also a lot of books available in the world that cover foraging and plant IDing. I highly recommend ones that show the edibles alongside its poisonous lookalikes. Some of the Peterson Field Guide books are really great at this, though they tend to be written for specific sections of the world, so keep that in mind when researching. And of course, the biggest advice I have for this path is don't consume anything you're not 100% sure of. I'm part of a few online communities that focus on foraging and mushrooming, and the number of posts that I see that say something like, "Oh, I ate this, and I thought it was maybe this, but now I'm not sure. Can someone ID it for me?" It's astounding. If you're not sure, ask before you eat. It's just not worth the risk. And since foraging is not witch-specific practice, you can pursue it in a public way while also being discreet. This is also a path that you can practice as a family or with others. However, be mindful that foraging can lead you into some delicate eco areas, so more feet equals more potential for damage. As with everything that takes you into natural spaces, mindfulness is key.
Yeah, and whether you're foraging or gardening, as you take from the plant or resource, make sure that you are, giving back a little bit of gratitude and energy to the places that you are, borrowing from. It's a cyclical relationship there, so mind's your P's and Q's, so to speak.
Absolutely, 100%. Now, with harvesting or foraging, taking those ingredients and adding a dash of other elements, we get kitchen witchcraft, or brewcraft, which we'll cover more when we talk about the fire element. And once you move inside the kitchen, this is a whole new witchcraft path to explore. So the kitchen witch, as the name suggests, is someone who weaves cooking and baking into their practice. And if you're interested in this, magics you can study or focus on would include herbs, garden and growing, flame, because you bring in that fire element when it comes to cooking, nature knowing, elixirs, anything that involves mixing a few elements. I personally practice kitchen witchery by really mindfully participating in the art of cooking and baking. Now, admittedly, this does not happen every time I cook. Sometimes you just have to be practical and get a meal on the table. But when I can take time, I really sink in. I connect with the ingredients and I feel gratitude for them, especially if something has given its life for this ingredient. I focus and I don't let outside things divide my attention, such as watching TV while I cook or mindlessly scrolling on Instagram. If there are moments where I have to get hands-on and doing like a repeated motion, like chopping or kneading dough, I really try to get sort of meditative with it, while also still being safe, of course. No one needs to cut a finger in this. And then I use my instincts where I can, and if there's wiggle room, measure the ingredients with my heart, though I don't recommend doing this for baking. Once the food is prepared, I consume it in a way that is a feast for all of the senses, by plating in a pleasing way, and that elevates your creation, and paying attention to all the nuances of the smell, the textures, what you can hear. Is there the sound of crackling crust from fresh baked bread? And then finally, taste and enjoy everything. Make this a mindful moment. One of my favorite resources for information when it comes to kitchen witchery is honestly cookbooks. They are my biggest sources of inspiration, especially if you have any that are precious and passed down by family members, or you have a collection of recipe cards from your grandma. These hold really special moments and energy to them. There are also a lot of books out there on kitchen witchcraft specifically. So I've not had any personal experience with them, but there's a couple by some authors I know, and they look pretty cool. So I would recommend checking them out and using your best judgment of if it's a good source for you or not. And my biggest tip is that a kitchen witch is only as good as her tools. Now, I'm not saying that you need to go out and spend money on fancy ingredients, but take care of what you have the same way that you would take care of your altar tools. Make your kitchen your sacred space, cleanse it at the end of the day, and have fun exploring new recipes and new ways to integrate magic into your cooking. And I don't know, if you're feeling a little uninspired or you hit a little bit of a low in your kitchen witchcraft, feel free to change things up in your physical space. This is where a little bit of that cottage witchery comes in, I think, but I know adding some fairy lights to a kitchen instantly makes it feel more magical, or changing up the decor, or even just rearranging how your pantry is can freshen up that sort of energy if you find yourself in a lull. Now, feeding people is probably my strongest love language, so to me, this witch path is very community-oriented. You can practice it alone, with friends and family, even get the kids involved. But hey, you also can practice it quietly and discreetly if you need to. There's no big showy rituals necessarily that's associated with kitchen witchery, so folks don't need to know that you're stirring a little magic into your morning coffee. And a quick note here is that, as Jay mentioned before about consent and not giving folks things without them knowing, I've seen videos and suggestions that you can discreetly add certain ingredients to food to cast spells upon people. Please do not do this without person's consent. And please don't add bodily fluids to items you want to consume. I've seen some suggestions for this, and it is very unsanitary. Just best to stay away.
Couldn't agree more. And, you know, to be a kitchen witch is someone who's able to wield all the elements to manifest joy and nourishment. I do consider myself a bit of a kitchen witch as well, although maybe in a slightly different genre than Alyssa. For me, there are a few other skills that so naturally combine all the elements, fire, water, earth, and air together. You know, fire, you've got heating, roasting, and grilling. For water, you've got boiling, soaking, and broths. Air, you've got cooking motions like stirring, whisking, and shaking. And earth, ingredients and equipment like cast iron and wood. And the specific magics that I focus on here are, you know, similar to Alyssa's, but also a little different. I go through herb, flame, water, ice, center, aroma, steam, and smoke. I'm not necessarily an expert in each of these magics, but they certainly all find their way into my own holistic kitchen work. My practice of kitchen witchery definitely has a few specialties. I don't consider myself an all-around amazing chef, but I also don't believe kitchen witchcraft is necessarily about creating immaculate food and drink. Obviously, whatever you make should probably be edible or imbibable to provide a quality output energetically. But the focus here is on connecting to your crafting on a deep energetic level and with clear intent in what you do. Specific to me, where I've found a rich connection between energetic transfer and kitchen work and meditative technique is in mixology and cocktail or mocktail making. Even in making drinks alone, fire, water, air, and earth all play essential roles when creating something fully infused with the energy I want it to convey. Being intentional with your ingredients is really key here, just as it is in all cooking. And for drinking making, that often means opting for creating things like syrups, bitters, infusions, or simple juices from the scratch ingredients themselves. A pretty easy example of this is grenadine, which is a common adder and is a reduction of pomegranate juice, sugar, and sometimes a bit of citrus juice. Now, while I don't always juice raw pomegranate seeds to make it, following the general steps, applying heat, blending, and cooling, all these provide a ritual through which you can apply your intent in layers. And doing so with gratitude and attention for each input and moment infuses it even more. Then you can build this concoction into more energetic layers for complexity in what you're resulting with. A really unique drink-making book I'll recommend here for those interested in this kind of work is Spirits of the Other World by Allison Krawbuck and Reese Everett. Unlike so many other cocktail books out there, they really prioritize the magical potential in this craft, and in many places guide you in not just making the drinks, but crafting the ingredients for the drinks too. What I love about utilizing cooking and drink making into an overall practice is because it is such an easily public kind of activity. You know, you're taking something you're likely gonna do every day and connecting it to something deeper, being more mindful in how you're doing it, without it being super obvious or requiring any big showy ritual, just like Alyssa said. And again, I will just double her advice. Just as we've mentioned, never use drink or food to cast spells.
There are so many ways to lean into a green path. And hey, if that's not your cup of tea, stay tuned for our episode on a stone way, where we'll explore crystals, stones, and bones, and even bring magics inside with cottage and hearth witchery.
As always, what makes Atomic Witchcraft thrive is all of you, so please join us again and engage us with your questions and thoughts anytime. You can stay connected by joining us on Patreon, Discord, or the Facebook listeners group.
We look forward to coming together for our next Sunday Haven, currently planned for Sunday, August 11th. We've got quite a busy summer ahead, which includes Jay and I moving homes, so a big focus on cottage craft there for us. But never fear, we will be releasing episodes on a weekly basis. This August marks 5 years, 100 episodes, and 1 year of Sunday Havens. So whether you are just joining us or have been around for a while, we want to celebrate with you. We will have a book giveaway and some free one-to-one guide sessions with Ash to raffle off. So stay tuned for a summer full of special episodes topped with some August revelry. Until we gather in this grove again,
make your world witchy.